The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Football Weekly, Anfield. Oh, Stephen. Once again, Liverpool skipper lets himself down in incident involving a bar in Liverpool, but this time no Phil Collins. Pod asks, is that it for Brendan Rodgers' side? Has their Cinderella run been ended by a slipper from their Prince Charming? And how happy must Mourinho be getting one over the critics and teaching Tim Sherwood how to rock a gilet? Elsewhere, there's more Premier League news. The new Man United, is one gig sufficient to upgrade their drive? And Sunderland breaking out of the bottom three. Plus, the latest from Europe as we look forward to the Champions League semi-final second legs. Bayern, Real Madrid, Chelsea, Atleti. All that plus post-tweets, etc. in Football Weekly. It's Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
It's Paul McInnes.
Hiya.
And it's Owen Gibson.
Hello there.
Hi, Owen. Busy weekend.
Busy weekend of football.
Yeah, it certainly was. Well, a weekend, of course, that started as well with the terrible news about Tito Villanova. Really sad to see that. We'll talk to Sid about that a little bit later on, the impact as well that it had on Barcelona. But we're going to begin with the Premier League and, of course, the big Sunday match at Anfield. Steven Gerrard. What a moment. What a moment.
Extraordinary. Absolutely. You know, extraordinary that it should be him. And it clearly, the extent to which it then affected him. I mean, every time he got the ball then 40 yards out, he was trying to score, wasn't he? I mean, kind of. And it's a lesson in pressure. Whereas the pressure and the pageantry's helped them so far. I mean, that was an example of it just telling on them, wasn't it?
Yeah. Do you feel for him, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure you can really construct much of a narrative out of the moment itself. I think there's just something that happened. People fall over. But you think you're all looking at me like it's
people fall over.
Yeah,
this was massive.
Well, it was massively consequential. But yeah. I'm not sure it was because of a failure of nerve or too much pressure getting to
what
him.
What was it? Did they water the pitch too much?
Well, just sometimes you get your foot in the wrong place, and sometimes things happen. I mean, it seems to me more like perverse fate. What happened after that? Yeah, exactly right. It's that he's been carrying a lot of the responsibility on his shoulders. You're not buying this at all.
No, it's not that. It's just I'm troubled by the. Sport is all about
luck.
No, but it's all about the descent of order into chaos and then making order of that chaos again. You start
that's
out
human life.
Yeah, it is, but that's why sport's such a glorious microcosm of it. Now you start out with your teams all arranged and you've got neat tactics and the scoreline says 0-0 and everything's perfectly symmetrical, and then the random elements start coming into play and everything descends into just random chaos. And sport, great moments of sport, is all about taking that chaos and restoring it to order. So a moment like that has to fit into a narrative for me, otherwise I just get very, very confused and sit in the
corner. I agree, that's what we spend all our time doing, isn't fitting them, trying to fit them into a...
Yeah, right. That's a natural human instinct. I would just say that it wasn't necessarily the case with that moment.
But afterwards,
for sure, this is a guy who is absolutely desperate to win this title. He's coming to the end of his career. He is the icon of that city.
He's against the Sonys, Barry.
He's against that team that he could have joined and the coach that he could have joined, who again proves why, you know, he probably would have won 10 times as many trophies as he did at Liverpool had he gone to Chelsea.
Mm.
And then it fell apart.
But even before then, they'd been sucked into Jose's evil master plan.
Right, let's talk about Mou's tactics. Obviously, they were controversial for a fixture that saw last year Suarez try and eat one of his own players. This time, Jose sent out a team featuring not only Salah, but also Barr. Definitely trying to tempt him there. Oh, there was also that defensive business.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's very difficult to play a football match when only one team wants to play. Very difficult. A match is about two teams playing. But this match was only one team playing and another team not. As a famous manager once said,
right,
about a different game.
That's also completely within the rules, isn't it? And,
Sky did a great compilation, actually. Sky Sports News did a compilation of all the times he's criticised other managers, including that post-West Ham press conference.
The 19th century football one.
Yeah, where they also pointed out that West Ham actually had more possession in that game at Stamford Bridge than Chelsea did Sunday at Anfield, but of course Chelsea had way more shots.
But I can't believe it's still news that Jose Mourinho's a hypocrite, because you know I think everybody knows that by now. You know, and he acknowledges it probably himself. But I mean, I thought Barney's piece this morning, Barney Mourinho's piece was quite right that you know kind of it does it is entirely within the rules to send your team out whichever way you like.
And it's also not that easy, is it, to do? I mean, as Liverpool says, it's not that easy to defend. Mourinho's gone up against the leaders of the Liga and the leaders of the Premier League in successive games, 180 minutes.
Take this team, take on this team that have been a force of nature in the last 10, 11 games, who've used that passion of the Anfield crowd to their benefit to sort of suck all that out and to get back on the front foot within kind of 15, 20 minutes. I thought was pretty extraordinary, really.
I can't go as far as to say it was extraordinary. I think it certainly was well performed, well executed. But you did have the point in the second half where you had 20-odd million Willian and 18 million Salah playing as double fullbacks. I think when you spend that much money, when you have that much ambition, there is a responsibility to try and engage constructively in a match like that. I think particularly when you look at the balance of the... You know, Liverpool have been a force of nature, but they're a callow force of nature. And the 11-game one, for the last three or four games, people are expecting it to come to a halt. And I think that for Chelsea to go little horse about it...
Yeah. No, absolutely, you're absolutely right there. And also, I mean, it plays into this sort of wider Abramovich narrative, doesn't it, about him, you know.
Does he want to win titles or does he want to win hearts?
Well, exactly. I mean, he's got rid of at least two or three managers because they weren't playing attractive football as well as winning. And now maybe he's plumped now for winning over style, or maybe there's another fork in the road to come.
This whole business of whether or not it's morally reprehensible to set out a very expensive team like this or not is getting very tedious. You know, you see articles written about Chelsea's tactics against Atletico or Liverpool or whoever else they've employed them against, and then the comments underneath are just monotonously predictable. You've Chelsea fans saying, "Hey, it's fine, you know, we can just nothing. It's well within the rules," and other fans, you know, slagging it off as anti-football and saying it's disgraceful. Now, obviously, it is well within the rules, and they've got 16 points out of 18 playing against the teams around them in the top four of the table. And it's up to Liverpool, the highest scoring team in the Premier League, to find a way through that, you know, those two banks of four that are well disciplined, and they weren't able to do it. So, and not only did Chelsea, you know, keep them scoreless, but they got two goals and won the game.
Both things can be true, can't they? I mean, if they do sort of block and nerdle their way to the European Cup again, history will record they won the European Cup, but everyone will also remember that they did it in a very tediously defensive way.
I think one other thing is to look at the tactics of Liverpool as well, and I think that actually they didn't really have an alternative when they were faced with all that.
The sort of no plan B, I think.
Yeah,
is right,
yeah. When it was all contracted into the middle of the pitch, they were trying to get cross the ball through all that number of players. They didn't have a physical presence in that area at any point, and they struggled.
Right, Jose singling out Callas for particular praise afterwards, because not only did they keep clean sheets against these big teams, but on Sunday they were doing it with a complete Chelsea rookie, basically, although he's a Czech international.
Yeah, I mean, he's played 2 minutes as substitute in the rest of the season, so you have to say it was a amazing performance by him to come in and do that in such a big game. But at the same time, he did have Cahill sitting on the bench. He'll probably be England's first choice central defender at the World Cup. So again, Jose can't have it that, you know, kind of poor old Chelsea having to chuck in the reserves. But at the same time, you have to appreciate what a good performance it was by Callas.
And a performance by Mourinho. I mean, it's always reflective of Mourinho, whatever he's talking about. And by playing that one inexperienced player in there who then went on and delivered a performance as if he'd been playing for years, it just goes to show how great a coach Mourinho is.
Yeah, also to get players like Willian doing a defensive role
and Schürrle
for 90 minutes. Yep. Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, now, what's this all mean for the title? I'm a bit confused. Crystal Palace, who've been doing wonders, of course, have won five straight wins. We did wonder whether, now that they were mathematically secure and all that, they would take their foot off the gas. Is that what happened when they hosted Man City, or was it the return of Yaya Toure? What was the narrative here, Paul?
Well, the narrative was that actually Palace didn't give up and they played. They nullified City for a long period of the game, but City scored within 3 minutes. They were contained well enough that they didn't really have much of a threat from Palace the other end. There were one or two flickers, and then exactly... Yaya Toure made the difference later on.
And they were clearly buoyed by the result they'd just seen. I mean, there was sort of collective will there, wasn't there, to seize the title race again.
So they're now 3 points behind, but with a game in hand against Villa. Let's play predictor, eh? This is always fun. Right now, Liverpool are on 80 points, Chelsea 78, City a point behind on 77. Next weekend, City have to visit Everton. What are the points going to be there?
Well, I see City winning that because I think Everton's thin
Barry
squad is starting to tell.
I'm just sick of making predictions.
Really? Paul?
What's the point?
It's my predictor.
I think City will win that one too.
All right, so I'm going to put City down.
I think City will win, but it's quite interesting in that Everton will probably want to lose and Liverpool will want Everton to win.
Right, right, that is interesting. All right, meanwhile, that same weekend, the next day, Chelsea host Norwich. I'm going to put 3 points there. That's 81. And on Monday, Crystal Palace host Liverpool.
You see, I think in narrative terms I could see Liverpool dropping a couple of points in that game. Because that sort of rigorous, massed, organised defence is what they're going to experience again at Selhurst Park. And I can see little psychodramas going on.
Do you think
there's going
to be a bit
on.
Of deflation as well, that euphoria that's been driving them on?
Yeah.
Almost certainly.
What do you think, Owen? They're going to draw at Selhurst Park?
I'm saying a draw as well, yeah.
Right. Barry, what do you think?
Sorry, which game is this?
Well, is it still Crystal Palace against Liverpool on Monday, next Monday?
I think Liverpool will beat them.
Okay. I'm going to go with Barry on that and completely ignore what you just said and give them the benefit of... So they're now on 83 points, 2 points still clear of Chelsea, and, of course, three of City. Then on Wednesday, City host Villa. So that's 3 points, isn't it? So they are on 83. And then on the final weekend, you'd basically have Liverpool, if they win that game at Crystal Palace, on 83 points along with City. Chelsea 2 points behind. The final weekend, Liverpool host Newcastle. Cardiff,
3 points for Liverpool.
Yeah. Cardiff will be hosting Chelsea.
3 points for Chelsea.
Right. And then City host West Ham.
3 points for City.
So then it all comes down to goal difference, because you'd have Liverpool... Liverpool basically have to win at Crystal Palace to ensure it goes to goal difference, and then they have to score
have to win by about 55. Yeah.
No, it's not that much.
It's
the goal
eight. It's eight.
Eight. Yeah.
And Chelsea.
Well, they're at home to Newcastle.
And City have got a game in hand, so it'll probably be about 10 by the time they come to the final record.
City's title. You can't see it. It's all down.
I can see it happening. And somebody said yesterday, you know, there's space for one more twist.
Will it come at Everton or Crystal Palace?
But it could still be Chelsea coming through. You know, it's not.
All right. Producer Ben's just really blown my mind by saying all Villa.
Surely not.
Yeah.
Well, Villa have played very well against the big sides this season.
That's a lot true. Didn't the they beat Man City earlier this season?
They did. And are likely to be still battling for something, whereas Cardiff.
That would be the somebody did ask us not to mention either twists or turns this week. That would be the biggest twist of all, potentially, wouldn't it?
What if Villa?
Yeah, in that game.
Spanner in the works.
Yeah. Wow. I tell you what.
Well, Villa are in severe danger of being relegated. Yeah.
And if City do win it, that would, you know, kind of completely change the perception of their season, wouldn't it? Because already people were writing, what, you know, they've spent all this money, they've had this season in which Chelsea are in transition, in which United are in transition, in which Liverpool have obviously come from a long way back. They felt like they should have won it. So, but if they do, then... Yeah.
Well, quite. If results have gone differently, indeed, this weekend, they could have gone into that clash with Everton at Goodison Park, only 2 points ahead of the Toffees, and it would have become a dogfight for a Champions League place. But anyway, none of that happened, so it's irrelevant.
It's irrelevant. That would be an alternative narrative.
Yeah, but it's not as much of a change of narrative of believing that it's your first title in 20 odd years.
Everyone stop saying narrative.
Story. Fable.
Random succession of events. All right,
chaos.
That's better. All right. Listen, that's it for part one. More where that came from in the shape of Champions League semi-final talk after this. Right, Champions League semi-finals. It's the second legs. Chelsea, Atletico on Wednesday. Tuesday, Bayern Munich trying to bring themselves back from a goal down at home to Real Madrid. In 10 meetings in Germany, Bayern have won 9 and drawn 1 against Real Madrid. Let's dial up Sid to get the Spanish take on these two big semi-finals. Sid, how are you?
Very well.
Good. All right, we'll start with... I was just talking about Bayern-Real and, you know, how that first leg was in some ways a very good result for Real, but in other ways they didn't get the goals that they wanted. They've not got a great record against Bayern. They've got Bale and Ronaldo both fit this time. And Guardiola, he had his virginity ended, as one Spanish paper put it, against Real in the last clash.
I assume that's a purely statistical response to the fact that it was the first time he'd been beaten at the Bernabeu.
Exactly. As far as I know, that's what they were talking about. Listen, Bayern had a 5-2 win this weekend against Werder Bremen to get themselves fired up. Real, though, had a big win as well.
Yeah, a big win and a very easy win as well. They won 4-0 against Osasuna. Cristiano Ronaldo scored two ridiculously good goals, and probably an illustration of the fact that, you know, even if you defend deep against Real Madrid, they have people who can shoot from distance and therefore force teams to come out to them, which in any case Bayern Munich will probably do, but it was very, very easy for Madrid 4-0 against Osasuna.
All right, well, they're on the cusp of their first Champions League final for 12 years. What's the feeling? Is the wind of destiny behind them?
Personally, I felt like things have kind of fallen into place a little bit for them all season. I think most Real Madrid fans would not be quite so bold as to say that, because they felt like they've been close before over the last 12 years, so they probably wouldn't go that far. But the first leg result, while it might have been better in that it's only 1-0 and everybody knows it'll be very difficult in Munich, it's the closest they've been. I mean, the last 3 years they reached semi-finals, but each time they went into the second leg, I think feeling that the first leg result hadn't been great. They were beaten 2-0 by Barcelona, of course. They were hammered by Borussia Dortmund, and they lost 2-1, if I remember correctly, against Bayern Munich in the first of those three semi-finals. So this is the first time they've gone into the second leg feeling like they've got the advantage, admittedly, away from home. But also within the Real Madrid camp, there's a very strong feeling that if Bale and Ronaldo are both fully fit, and Bale, of course, has been ill over the last few days, and Ronaldo's come back from an injury but looked great at the weekend, if they're both fully fit, they have so much pace and so much ability to break that I think it's likely that they'll score, and I think within the camp at Real Madrid, they believe it's likely they'll score as well.
All right, is it going to be an all-Madrid final then, Sid?
Possible, and you know, to talk about whether the result is a good one or not, obviously after the Atletico Madrid game, both Chelsea and Atletico were able to feel like it was a good result. Atletico Madrid clung to the fact that Chelsea hadn't scored an away goal, and so therefore anything they get at Stamford Bridge immediately changes the way the tie is set up. My money before the two first legs was on Real Madrid-Chelsea final. I think it still is.
All right, they can get two results out of three. They've got Gabby suspended. Is Turan injured?
No, Turan's come back off an injury. He played a little bit the weekend.
All right.
I think it will depend how Simeone wants to set it up as to whether or not Turan plays, because there's been a reasonable amount of kind of interchanging of those extra midfielders all year. I mean, Koke's largely played all season, but Turan or Raul Garcia or David Villa or the creative players on either side, that's changed a little bit at times. Turan came at the weekend. For what it's worth, I mean, obviously everybody's talking about the absentees for Chelsea, which of course are significant. But missing Gabby's a really, really big deal for Atletico Madrid.
Right. Well, Chelsea looking very composed in their clash with Liverpool. How did Atleti do in their trip to Valencia Sunday?
Well, they won 1-0. They won 1-0 with yet another late run into the area, yet another header, yet another goal for Raul Garcia, who's another midfielder who's been brilliant, despite at the start of the season thinking that he wasn't going to play that often this year. He's basically got himself into the team by consistently providing goals. I think I'm right in saying that in all competitions that might have been his 16th of the season. I'm not 100% sure of that stat. And they were tough. Atletico, they were very hard to break down. They took that chance, and terrible mistake from Vicente Guaita, the Valencia goalkeeper. They also had a couple of other good chances, one of which Diego Costa wasted, but another victory, that's 9 in a row. And I can't remember the exact number, but I've got a feeling that of those 9 victories in a row in the league, I think they might have kept 7 clean sheets.
Ooh, it's going to be quite a tight affair then, possibly.
But Atletico are now, obviously, as you probably know, three games away from the end of the season. They need 2 wins to win the league for sure. Mm. They go away to Levante in the next game, at home against Malaga, the game off that, and then, of course, Barcelona on the final day.
Right.
Which is why, bizarrely, of course, Real Madrid fans are cheering on Barcelona right now, because the last thing they want is Atletico going there on the final day and Barcelona not having anything to play for.
Yeah. It's only 4 points between Atletico Madrid and Barcelona at the top. Real Madrid are currently 6 points behind, but with a game in hand over the two teams above them. Yeah. Barcelona had to come back from 2-0 down in their clash away at Villarreal. See, I have to tell, I was quite surprised to see them even playing this weekend after the terrible news about Tito Villanova.
Yeah, nobody has said so
explicit?
Kind of complaining way.
Right.
Nobody has kind of come out and said, look, we shouldn't be playing, this is terrible. But I think at Barcelona there is a feeling that it might have been better not to have played this. Although I suppose to some extent a return to normality is the way that clubs sometimes feel like, or a return to normality, a continuation of normality is the way that clubs sometimes feel is the best way to deal with it. And I think it probably was, you know, genuinely a really quite difficult for them, and they won 3-2. They were 2-0 down, 2 own goals to make it 2-2, and then Messi scored, at the end. And there was this kind of strange sensation as well, because of the two own goals. Clearly, Barcelona's players wanted the opportunity to dedicate a goal to Peter Villanova. But obviously, two own goals, you sort of don't really celebrate them, and you don't really dedicate them either. So it kind of had to wait until Messi got the third.
Right. I mean, their players, a lot of them will have grown up with Villanova. I mean, they were young kids.
Villanova's first job was with Barcelona's cadetes, a youth team, a team of 13-year-olds, which had Piqué, Cesc, and Messi in it. Even beyond that, you know, he was assistant coach to Pep Guardiola in the Barcelona B team that won the third division, and that was Sergio Busquets and Pedro, both of whom no one had heard of, and a year later the World Cup winners, which is, I think, very much down to Tito and Pep Guardiola. Quite apart from having been their coach, which of itself, of course, is huge. And for a lot of the players, this is someone who they've grown up with. And I think, in particular, for Cesc Fabregas and Leo Messi and Gerard Piqué, Cesc Fabregas, despite the fact that he left the club, again, I think Tito Villanova was very, very important indeed.
Mm. All right. The other news from the Barcelona trip to Villarreal was the Dani Alves incident, which probably everyone's seen by now, where some fool throws him a banana and Dani Alves responds in pretty remarkable fashion.
Yeah, Dani Alves picked it up, took a bite, took the corner. At this stage, it's 2-0. They then obviously come back to 2-2 with two own goals. The two own goals off assists from Alves, if you can call them assists, and he provided the cross for both goals. Terrible crosses, in truth, in both cases, but they led to the goals. And Alves said after the game, well, I don't know who it was, but it was very good, because that little bit of extra potassium from the banana enabled me to deliver the two crosses from which we scored the two goals. He said, you know, I think the phrase was, we shouldn't give too much importance to these retards. I think that was the word he used. And he said that this has been happening, and this in a way was the phrase where I then start to wonder if it is the right approach or not, and I'm sort of doubtful about it. Is he said, look, this has been happening for 11 years. Obviously, it's 11 years that he's been in Spain, first joined Sevilla. There's nothing we can do about it, so the best thing to do is to laugh at it. And if you don't treat it as anything important, they failed. I quite like that attitude up to a point, but of course what it does do is it means that it doesn't get challenged, and in a way I'm not sure if that is the most helpful attitude, but his response was brilliant, because it does make, I hope at least, that it does make the fan look extremely stupid. Actually, part of the problem perhaps has been that it hasn't been treated as significantly important.
Ideally, he'll have a laugh at the idiot who threw it, and then the Spanish FA will come down really hard and find a bloke and give him a nice punishment. Sid, brilliant.
Well, I mean, there was a famous case, James. Yeah. I know you wanted me to be brief, but it's worth mentioning this. Yeah. A few years ago, two bananas were thrown at Carlos Kameni, who is the Cameroonian goalkeeper at the time. I'm not honestly sure if he was at Malaga or if he was at Espanyol. I think he was at Espanyol at the time. And there was a 601 euro fine, so obviously 300 euros and 50 cents for each banana. And I think at the time that kind of brought home that it wasn't being treated seriously enough.
Right, that's bananas, Sid. That's bananas. All right, lovely. We look forward to catching up with you on Thursday after those semis.
Okay, speak to you then.
Thank you, Sid.
Is there a possibility that it wasn't actually a racist gesture, but in light of the conversation we had in last week's pod, someone in the crowd had just discovered the banana in the bowl with the rest of the fruit and had tried to get it as far away from it as possible, and it just happened to land by the corner flag?
Right.
Or spotted some unripened oranges in the corner by the corner flag and is just trying to aid the process of ripening.
I'm just putting that out there because I like to think the best of everyone.
At least two sides to every story. Okay. Now, also this weekend, I don't know if you saw, Sunday night, Vujadin Boskov dying. 82 years of age, the former Yugoslavia, Real Madrid, a really long list of teams he managed. But he said his sweetest success was with Sampdoria, and certainly the years I spent in Italy, he was an absolute legend there, because he took that great Sampdoria side, Paul, the one with Vialli, Mancini, Vieccaward, all those great names, Cerezo. He took them to not only the Italian title, but then to the final of the Champions League, back when it was a knockout competition and quite hard to do.
Called the European Cup.
Yeah, and called the European Cup. And, of course, they lost to Barcelona at Wembley after Mancini missed a penalty. Yeah. But Mancini writing a lovely editorial in today's Gazette saying, thanks, Vujadin, remembering the day when he first walked in. he was a real character, Bosco. I know they always say he was a real character, but he had this kind of very playful... he basically laughed at everything. He came out with these weird kind of Yoda-esque quotes, like, which in the hysterical world of Italian football were quite well appreciated. He would say things like, "Penalty is when a referee whistles," and stuff like that. They like that. Anyway, so he had a remarkable career, and Mancini says, "Thank you, Vujicic, because you made my youth quite extraordinarily beautiful," which was a nice thing to say, Mancini. Anyway, other Italian news, quickly off the back of that, Roma made it 9 straight wins last Friday by beating Milan 2-0. Have you seen Miralem Pjanic's goal?
No.
Or go and have a look for it, Barry. Okay. And you, listener, go and have a look.
I believe Mario Balotelli got very upset after the game.
Well, he did.
With one of my heroes, Vladimir Boban, who was a pundit in the studios. Well,
it was Giancarlo Morocchi who was a former Juve and Bologna player. Basically, they're all pundits now, and Boban. According to James Horncastle, Boban then accused him of being nihilistic in his approach to football, which is exactly the sort of thing Boban would say with his little round spectacles and his bookshelves of Russian literature. Anyway.
And his personal bank.
And
his expensive bar and grill, which pervades the world's most expensive cheese and ham sandwiches.
Yeah, you've eaten at the table of Boban, haven't you?
Very disappointed.
But anyway, back to Balotelli. So he was taken off during this 2-0 defeat by Roma at the Stadio Olimpico, and he had a bit of a strop with Seedorf on his way out, and then afterwards he gamely went up for the interviews, and Morocchi in the studio was saying, Balotelli, I don't know if you've noticed strikers over the last 5-10 years, but they move around a little bit now. I mean, he wasn't quite as dripping with sarcasm as that, but he said basically, you need to move around. Have a look at strikers worldwide, that's what they do. Balotelli, listen to this, gamely presented himself for the interview afterwards, and Balotelli said, I heard your pundit, and he doesn't understand anything about football. Morocchi, you don't get football. Trust me, at this point, Boban comes in and apparently says stuff about nihilism, which I hope he did. So it all got quite ugly, and now there's this big thing. In fact, yesterday's Gazzetta was suggesting that Prandelli's not going to even use him in the Italy team in the World Cup. I don't know about that. He was the big star for them at the Euros, and he does have that special ingredient.
He's got a knack of delivering on the big occasions.
For Italy, not necessarily.
So he won't even be in the squad, you reckon?
Well, I think he would be in the squad, but the idea is that they'd be going for a plan B. But who would you go with? I mean, there's Ciro Immobile, who's scoring loads of goals, but there's no one with that, Fabio Barini, says producer Ben. Anyway, there you go. That's more than enough about that, because there's other world football news. World football news, like Ajax celebrating their fourth successive Dutch title. Frank de Boer, the first manager to ever achieve that.
World football news, such as Fenerbahce winning the Turkish title in front of 50,000 women and children.
Oh, that's lovely.
Because,
why was that?
Because adult men were banned from the stadium on the back of violence at a previous game.
That's a great disciplinary procedure, isn't it?
You thought it was a gesture for a minute. Only women and kids today, but no, they're just all being banned.
Wow, that's great. If you're curious, Paul, about the situation in Russia, Andriy Villas-Boas in charge of Zenit St. Petersburg. He's had 6 games in charge. He's won all 6. Never has a manager come into the Russian league and won his first 6 games. It means they're still top of the table, our Zenit, which is appropriate, really. Yeah, and they're facing the team in second place, Lokomotiv Moscow, next weekend. There's only 1 point between them. Pwah!
Some great pictures of AVB on the Zenit.
Weren't they fabulous?
Yeah, go and have a look. Very good.
I assumed that those were mock-ups.
Yeah, what they're like. He's just sort of in various regal poses, isn't he?
There's one fabulous one that's kind of through a kind of cornfield with a forest in the background, and he's in a kind of woodland glade, but he's gazing down as if thinking of Love's Lost, or
he's thinking very hard at all of them. Is he crouching? Is he crouching?
No, he's looking like he's just composed an album of folk songs, and this is the cover shot. They're great. I assume they were photoshopped, but they're not. They're genuine.
Where are they?
On the Zenit website.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to the one with him riding a horse half naked or wrestling salmon.
With a message to Daniel Levy.
Anyway, let's do some championship news and then a bit of music. But that championship news, Paul, As a Norwich fan, you've been looking at brochures, I imagine, of the second tier.
Yeah, I've been trying to find ways in which I might be enthused about the prospect of returning to the division.
There's a lot to be enthused about at the moment.
Highly competitive division.
You want chaos.
I think in a way it's more fun competing at the top end of the championship
That's the thing you end up. There's a lot of people who say that.
That's what you're convincing yourself.
I'm not entirely sure.
I think the tension
and the competitiveness of the top division is more enthralling, really.
Yeah, you too, actually, Barry and Paul, you're the yin and yang, aren't you, of supporting a club near the bottom, because Sunderland, we'll talk about Sunderland shortly, but Norwich at the moment in the bottom three, but you like a bit of chaos. How about the situation down there at the top and bottom of the Championship? Just one more weekend to go. You've now got Derby and QPR are assured of two of the playoff spots. Of course, we already know that Burnley are coming up and the Championship winners Leicester. But then you've got two more teams going to get into the playoffs. Four contenders for that. They're only separated by 3 points. Reading, Wigan, Brighton and Blackburn. Blackburn have to go to Wigan in that final game.
Wigan have got game in hand, of course.
Oh, right, have they? Well, that's ever so tight. So Wigan look a good bet, and then there's one of Reading and Brighton and Blackburn. Well, down at the bottom, Yeovil and Barnsley are already down. So then you've got one of five teams, again, only 3 points separating them, Blackpool, Charlton, Millwall, Doncaster and Birmingham.
I mean, Birmingham all of a sudden are in freefall, aren't they?
Although they've got a game in hand as well, as do Charlton. I'm not going to call that. Should we do predict Trump then? No, let's not. Let's not.
Looking at this top six,
yeah,
Wigan might be the ones who are just finally stumbling out. They've been on a great run for a long time on Uwe Rosler, but they've also played a mammoth amount of games back-to-back.
Wow, this will be 60 games for them by the end of the season.
Well, exactly. And I think, you know, Brighton, you know, Reading have turned around a chunky period of form with two back-to-back wins, and Brighton haven't been beaten in seven.
Right.
So there's, a real threat that Wigan's another great season for them will come unfortunate end, just like last year.
Exciting stories at all of them. Uwe Rosler there at Wigan and Reading, of course, Seagulls in the Premier League. That would be amazing, wouldn't it? But what about Blackburn getting the Venkies back in the big time? We'd all love that, wouldn't we?
Yeah, well, considering they weren't aware that you could actually be relegated from the Premier League when they bought the club.
And the fact that it's been,
maybe they don't know you can get promoted from the Championship.
Perhaps.
But it'd be the ultimate, well, not the ultimate story, there's been several of them, but it'd be a classic example of a club succeeding despite its owners rather than because of them, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. Still, they are down in eighth place, so producer Ben says they shouldn't count their chickens, that producer Ben. One post quickly from Broken Bill. He says, I hope you will comment on these two stories on Monday's pod. Huddersfield's Adam Clayton dyeing his massive beard in club colours for charity. It was great, wasn't it? It's blue and white.
Yeah, he's shaved it off now.
Oh.
But he raised money for charity.
Oh, I see. The job done.
He looked like an extra from Braveheart, didn't he, with that claymore in hand.
Aye. Right. Oh, the other story that Broken Bill once mentioned is the MLS player who has a pepperoni pizza hair because he will apparently do anything for endorsement money. Broken Bill's words, not mine. He's referring to Columbus Crew striker Dominic Oduro, who previously celebrated a goal by taking a bite of a pizza he'd arranged to have waiting for him. That's brilliant.
What would UEFA make of that, though, after the Paddy Power business?
Oh, yeah, good shout. Mm-hmm. So now he's shaved into the side of his head a special pepperoni pizza hairdo. Go and have a look. Anyway, we'll be back with more tweets and stuff after this. Lots of people posting in interesting things. We talked about the first club to have executive boxes. Sean Ingall seemed to think it was Luton. A lot of listeners are saying he's just plain wrong. Jeremy Faxman reckons Oldham Athletic. Shaker Fox has Leicester. Brendan O'Keefe says he once saw a film with Albert Finney in it, which featured a scene at Old Trafford in what seemed to be a corporate box. I don't know. That one's going to run around. That was from
it's quite interesting,
1967.
Isn't it? That some of the names that are suggested, they're not the big glamour clubs. And I'm pretty sure Sean will be on the money with his Luton.
Really?
Fans. He tends to be. Ooh. But it was when they were all redeveloping those plastic pitches and stuff in the 80s, all these modern...
Well, these people are saying back in the 60s or 70s. Don't know.
But how do you find an executive box as well? Does it have to be one with a view of the pitch? Because obviously there were corporate banqueting facilities before that, weren't they?
All right. It's not a tangent we want to get on, I don't think. Duc de Blangis says, if anyone has seen Drag Me to Hell, that's how I feel now. I mocked Pulis, the disgusting, dentally challenged woman. Have you seen the film? You know, the gypsy.
Yeah.
Earlier in the season. And now Norwich are being dragged to the Championship and Tony's going to be gumming on my chin forever. Great film.
It is.
Yeah, very scary, of course. Well, there you go. That's Norwich, who lost 4-0 at Man United. Boy, what a turnaround for Man United. They bring in Ryan Giggs, and the bad old days of David Moyes are over. He only managed, what? A 4-0 win against Norwich at Carrow Road.
Yeah, in the space of one match, it's all changed around. I mean, I don't think anyone's getting, apart from the fans who are inside Old Trafford on Saturday, I don't think anyone's getting too carried away, least of all Ryan Giggs. And, you know, I don't really buy this idea that if he wins all four, the momentum will be unstoppable and they'll have to give him the job.
I think he's sensible enough.
I think Giggs is sensible enough to know that he could do with another perhaps year or two learning at the feet of somebody else before he takes the job.
All right. Interesting. He wears a suit, though. A man who was Sunday, he posts on the subject of managers, Gary Monk, would have a much better chance of getting the Swansea job if he swapped his tracksuit gilet combo for a good suit. Standing managers, if they stick with training ground wear on match day, send out the signal that's where they belong. But putting on a club tie and jacket, Ryan Giggs convinced people he can manage one of the world's biggest clubs.
Worked really well for David Moyes, didn't it? Always wearing that club blazer. Although I did sort of like the delineation between Giggs and his suit and the rest of the class of 92 in their sort of club tracksuits.
What was it? He dropped Mata. And then Mata came back in and scored. But what was there, any big difference in Man United?
Well, certainly
not Fellaini. Norwich.
The first half an hour, Norwich were reasonably robust, and United did struggle with the final ball. They had a lot of possession, but they didn't really know what to do with it at the end. And also, while they were playing with confidence, they weren't playing with an intensity. And then we managed to have a kind of a Berkeley, Busby Berkeley style musical can-can line with three defenders missing the ball, and then the fourth pulling down Danny Welbeck for a penalty. And then we lost.
Is that something
confidence.
You work on the training ground, or is it just?
I think we must do because we do it so uncannily often. But you know, that was about 2 minutes before half time, with 2 minutes after half time, Rooney had found his shooting boots and not been closed down, and then after that, it was a parade.
Right, but it was exactly the same result when Man United faced Norwich under David Moyes
in the Carling Cup.
Not
in the league.
All right then. Of course, Norwich now in the bottom three. I'm going to quickly mention, because otherwise we'll forget, Stoke Spurs. Spurs with a win. Ryan Shawcross with a red card, which means he'll miss next weekend's clash with Fulham, which is going to be relevant in a second or two. And Saints beating Everton. Saints failed to score, but won 2-0.
Indeed, yeah. And you know, I've actually, given all the stuff that was around with the change of ownership and all the rest of it, Southampton was supposed to be a meltdown. They've had a very good end to the season, and obviously a lot will depend on what happens in the summer there, won't it?
Yeah, absolutely. As for Everton's summer, it doesn't look like it's going to be preparing for the Champions League now, but Blue Dylan saying, one thing to mention about the lifting of Barcelona's transfer embargo, it means we have secured Deulofeu for a second loan season, according to Spanish paper AS. That's interesting news. I wasn't across that. Thanks, Blue Dylan. Right, let's get on to, then, the relegation battle. We can begin with Sunderland, Barry. A miracle. A miracle called Connor Wickham. Guest poet saying he's changed everything for us.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Someone on Twitter said yesterday I should take all the credit because I called this a couple of weeks ago that Wickham was going to get them out of a pickle. And it's turning out to be the case. I mean, there's a lot done, a lot more to do, but they've given themselves a really good chance of staying up now.
It's an amazing story as well, really. I saw him a couple of times at Sheffield Wednesday, and it wasn't exactly, although, you know, he did well there, it wasn't exactly pulling up trees, and then to come back and do what he's done.
It seems to be clearly a very much a confidence player, and Niall Quinn was saying yesterday that when he arrived at Sunderland first, he seemed to think he'd made it and wasn't really putting in the effort at training, you know, last onto the training pitch and first off it, which is the exact opposite. You hear these high-achieving players, many of them. But you would expect him to score in every game now, whereas before that wouldn't have been the case. You wouldn't even expect Sunderland to score in any game.
Uh-huh.
And they've three games left away to Manchester United, which I wouldn't expect them to get
anything. Hang on, that's predicted territory. We're coming to that shortly. But that's five goals down and three for him. Paul?
Yeah, I just think quickly, somebody who could maybe learn from Conor Wickham's experience is Wilfried Zaha. Somebody who similarly had one good season in the Championship. Big money move. Have lost all confidence and display a bad attitude.
He didn't come on to the field, did he, in this game?
He did in the second half.
And he was running at players occasionally with a strength and a grace. You think, oh, this guy could be a real prospect. But other times, he was just ambling. Yeah, right. Most of the time, he was ambling.
But, I mean, Wickham seems to have been knocking around for years, but he's still only 21, you know. And I would suggest if he keeps up the hard work and any success he gets this season doesn't go to his head, he could have a very, very bright future.
I'd take him.
Really?
Yeah, as that plan B instead of Andy Carroll. If you're going to go for a team, if you're going to go for a squad where effectively there's no pressure and you're blooding a lot of youngsters anyway, because you're going to have to replace like Sterling because of Walcott going out, why not take another one?
All right. Good for you, Paul.
Young Lions.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Heard it here first.
And last.
But yeah. There was quite a bit of controversy in it over
that red card.
The red card and the penalty won by Wickham. I mean, let's not forget as well, scoring two yesterday, he created the other two. One by staying on his feet when he was fouled en route to the penalty area, and the foul continued into the penalty area, which meant it was a penalty, despite thousands of people on Twitter claiming otherwise. That's pretty much it. It was an excellent bit of refereeing from Phil Dowd. And I'm not just saying that because the team benefited, but Gus Poyet described it as the best bit of refereeing he'd ever seen.
All right, another impartial
winner. Again, he would say that.
So, anyway, Sunderland now reside above the drop zone on goal difference. Norwich drop into it, and Cardiff are now bottom. Basically, West Brom are... Well, OK, we'll start at the bottom. Cardiff are 30 points, Fulham on 31, Norwich on 32... Sunderland also on 32, Villa 3 points above them, and West Brom a point more than them. So West Brom currently 4 points above the bottom three.
And would you even make West Ham necessarily safe?
Well, 37, they're on 37, and so are... Who's the other team on 37?
Hull.
Well, now Hull got the point in that remarkable 2-2 draw at Craven Cottage, which saw Fulham take the lead, and then they looked all sorted, but they were just burnt out by that point. And they collapsed. There's a bit of a comedy moment for the first goal, and they left little Shane Long completely unmarked for the second. And apparently Fulham staff in tears after that game, and they thought it was all up. They've got to go and win at Stoke now. Paul, I'm going to go predictor on you, but after we mentioned Swansea Villa quickly, because Villa are even more in trouble, just 1.6 after their defeat at Swansea, which featured a brace from Boney and that remarkable John Joe Shelby goal. But I guess we're going to riff on Villa's pain here, aren't we?
Yeah, that was a wonderful strike, you know, back in the Rooney mould. But I think
better than Rooney.
Better than Rooney.
Yeah. Why did you make that one better than Rooney?
Just because it seemed more considered to me. I mean, Rooney seemed more of a hit and hope.
Right. The thing about it is, about of all the teams, I think that's the bottom three is now set from my point of view. But I think the only other one who might fall back in, you know, perhaps Sunderland, but Sunderland have their mo, is Villa. But I think it's going to require at least 4 points for Norwich and 2 wins for the other two to pull them in. And I think even though Villa have a horrible set of fixtures in their final three games, I don't know that the bottom three won't do enough.
I mean, even if they escape, which I think Villa probably will, it's been another awful season for them. I mean, this was supposed to be the year in which everything after last season, where everything started to come together and those young players started to gel and all the rest of it. And now you've got Lerner saying nothing about his future intentions, and you've got Lambert no longer the sort of coming young manager, but looking, you know, fairly clueless.
I'm going to make a shout. Sunderland go down. They're the team that's going to drop into the bottom three and get somebody out of jail. You know why? Their next game is away at Man U. Ryan Giggs' Destiny's Man U.
Give you that one.
Okay. Then they host West Brom in a bitter relegation dogfight. Both of those teams cannot afford to take their foot off the gas. That could easily go the wrong way. They could easily get just 1 point from that. Yeah?
Which would be enough.
Well, it'd be enough to keep them 1 point maybe ahead of Fulham. We'll come on to that in a second.
They need 4 points.
Their final game, Barry, is against Swansea, who've also got their mojo back in a big way.
But who will be very slow.
Swansea you might get one point on the last day of the season.
You might get one point from your last three games, and you're only goal difference above Norwich at the moment. Have some of that, Paul.
No, I mean, that's, you know, I can see a narrative for Norwich where there is absolutely...
No more narrative.
Well, I'm going to use that word. I like that word. I'm going to use it. I'm not going to be shouted down at the boars in this room.
That's quite a turnaround from part one when you slapped me down for saying there is no such thing. It's just random events, don't you?
That's narrative.
Yeah.
When it's your team. I say there's a massive desire to find narrative, and sometimes it's just not there. Okay?
All right.
So, okay, I can see a situation on the last day where we've all but given up hope, and that is the way in which we managed to beat Arsenal.
But when the pressure's Arsenal, on, we're not who may have their one eye on the FA Cup final and have already been safe in fourth place.
But it's been our rotten luck that Moyes gets sacked before we go, and then Chelsea are suddenly back in the title race.
Yeah, you've had rotten luck, haven't you?
We have had rotten luck, mate, yes.
Says Broadcasting's second most famous McInnes.
That's right.
Tom McInnes, of course, as viewers of a certain Sunday Night Highlight show will know, because he was he just randomly stopped? He was your brother.
No, they put out a call to, you know, a call for people on social media, and my brother replied because he was going up to Old Trafford.
Oh,
and
okay.
So they selected him partly for his bright yellow and green retro Admiral tracksuit top, but also because he's quite eloquent and, unlike me, able to keep his sentences down to about three or four words.
What did he say? Because I didn't see this.
He just said that we've been in terrible form. It's been a very hard season. And then after,
are you adopting your brother's accent? Because you subtly changed your voice when you said that.
No, well, yeah, I'm trying to sound more reasonable and rational, my brother. And then after the game, they come back to him and he says, well, yeah, that was terrible. It was a capitulation. We're going down now.
It's pretty good. Is he and free on Thursdays?
Yes. Yeah.
Would it be cliche to suggest that they could have picked any Norwich fan and they would have been related to you?
It's not a cliche.
Barry,
it's an
I'm not going to have jokes about Norwich being inbred on this show. Please.
Sorry. I couldn't resist. It's childish.
Yeah.
That's the one when he's reverse engineered the racism banana joke. And that's that I meant joke. It really is blue material, Barry. One for the dads.
Yeah.
He's currently being escorted out the Guardian building as we speak, don't worry.
All right. Well, that's it then for Football Weekly. Remarkable week ahead of us. As we head into the very, very exciting final act of this season. Do join us then on Thursday. In the meantime, many, many thanks to Owen, to Paul, and to Barrett, and to producer Ben. And have a super week.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.